pick up more or less where we left off. We had this PMU system of equations, which were claimed to describe the full planar spectrum of n equals 4 super young Mills. We had these P functions, which were some Q functions living in this SL4/4 Q system of relations, and then these other matrices mu, which govern the analytic continuation of these P functions around their branch points. And then these P functions had some, and mu functions had some given asymptotics, which encoded the quantum numbers of the state. So before we get straight to the example, let's just quickly discuss some symmetries that this system have. So let's remind what these relations were. So we had these P functions, PA, when analytically continued around the branch point at plus minus 2G, was given in terms of these matrices mu AB, P upper B, where P upper B was chi BC PC, sum over C, where this chi was this like anti-diagonal matrix minus 1, 1, minus 1, 1. And similarly, we had mu AB of U plus I minus mu AB of U was PA PB tilde minus PA PB A tilde. Okay, so one very obvious symmetry that we have corresponds to this changing the basis of these P functions. So given any P, we can just do a rotation by some constant matrix H. PB. Okay? And similarly, under this transformation, mu will go to so H inverse mu chi H. Okay, but we shouldn't allow just any H, because we mentioned in the last lecture that these, like the asymptotics of the quantum number were encoded in these P's. So in particular, if we restrict to L equal to 2, then we had these PAs asymptotically behaved like U to the minus 2, U to the minus 1, U to the 0, and U. So you take the formulas I get from the last lecture, plug in L equals 2, you get this. Okay? So we still want to define P1 as the guy who has U to the minus 2 asymptotics at large U. P2 should be the guy who goes like U to the minus 1, and for example, P4 should be the guy who goes like U. So in general, if we do a generic transformation with this H, which is invertible, then we're going to start mixing these asymptotics. So to keep the identification of P1 as the guy who goes like U to the minus 2, it shouldn't be allowed to mix with anybody. So in particular, this H should have the following structure, where it should be lower triangular. Okay, so this means that P1 can only be expressed in terms of P2, but there's no problem with writing a linear combination of P2 with P2 and P1, because the degree of P1 is lower than P2, so it won't affect the asymptotic power. Okay, but also we had these other relations, which were like A1, A4 as being some function of, say, like the delta, the length, and the spin, and so on. And similarly, with A2 and A3 was some other relation like this. And we also want to preserve these. So in particular, we should restrict to these transformations. For example, here we would have, say, A, B, B inverse, A inverse, which will allow us to preserve the asymptotics, but also allow us to preserve these combinations A1, A4, and A2, A3. Okay, so now we start turning to the explicit solution. So when we wrote down these
You wrote you explained here one nice symmetry of these equations. There are many more, probably, right? I mean, or no, or this is more or less it. It's just this. This is the symmetry of the equations.
So when you write down a generically write down a Q system, the most general thing you can do is write take linear combinations of these Q functions, right? Because you have determinants. So if you add one Q function to another, this extra thing you add out just gives you zero. But beyond that, I mean, this is the only sort of like a continuous semi-symmetry that I can think of. Of course, there are all these sort of like anti-automorphisms you can do where you like send P to his Hodge dual and so on. But at least in terms of continuous symmetries, this is like the only one that I can think of. Do you have anything else like in mind?
Maybe it's included in this. No, I had in mind multiplying by periodic functions and stuff like
right. that. Right. So so you don't want to multiply by periodic function because then you change the class of function. So you will now get some, for example, some exponential growth or decay at infinity, which is not consistent with this like parallax structure. So provided you want to preserve parallax asymptotics, the most you can multiply by periodic function, but it should be constant in order to preserve this parallax nature.
I mean, there were cuts on the U-plane, right?
Yes.
Yes. So this is about some sheet.
Yeah, so this is all written on like the, this statement about asymptotics is on like the defining sheet of these functions. Where they
how many sheets are there?
Infinitely many. So I speak about the defining sheet where these p's just have a single cut.
Could you fix h farther by going in another, under another cut and then requiring something like an opposite behavior?
Yeah, so I mean, at the moment, this thing is like pretty generic. It's just based on what I want to happen on the defining sheet. But I don't think that will. I don't think that should.
Like it could require that p four goes like 1/u² on the second cut.
No. So the point of like all these equations is that the value of these p functions and so on any sheet of the Riemann surface is completely fixed by their value on the first sheet. So once you know how these behave on the first sheet,
so you can act with h. I'm saying you could fix this gauge symmetry further by imposing conditions on the other sheets.
Sure. I mean, you can definitely like restrict like the values of these things in some way. But I mean, it depends a bit on what you want to do. So for the example I'm going to do, I'm going to completely fix this gauge symmetry in some way, and then we have no freedom, and then we solve. OK, so we were looking at this SL2 sector of operators. So trace.
So if you cross the defining sheet and go to the other one, you have infinitely many cuts.
Yes.
Right? And now if you go to the right, away from the cut, what's the syntactic behavior there on the second sheet? It's an essential singularity, right? So.
Well, you would still have parallax behavior at infinity.
Really?
Yeah. So it comes from from this equation, right? So we know. So this is p on the second sheet.
Yeah.
Which is expressed in terms of mu and p on the first sheet.
So p is power law, but mu you said is periodic, right?
No, mu behaves parallax at infinity. Remember we had this like mu goes to like u to the like delta minus j or something like this.
But with delta, okay. It's a power but with a non-integer power.
Yeah, exactly. This reflects the fact that you have an infinite number of cuts, so you go asymptotically, this sort of like condenses into some like
asymptotic. What I was asking is equivalent to the question, can you fix some the behavior of mu so that this symmetry goes away?
Can I fix what, sorry?
The behavior of mu. Components of mu, like say, okay, these components decays a bit faster.
So asymptotically, it should be completely fixed just by definition. So the symmetry is defined in such a way that it does
go to one, and you can use h to make one of them go to zero, right?
So you can affect the subleading behavior for sure. For example, something we do is like, for example, choose this h such that maybe the subleading coefficients of p maybe they vanish or something like this. So you have some freedom, but asymptotically, these things should just be well defined. This h shouldn't affect asymptotically. It's defined in such a way that it doesn't.
Of p, but it affects the ones of mu. By just forgot it. You just forgot how it acts on mu, right? So that affects the asymptotics of mu. Like specific coefficients in asymptotic behavior.
Yeah, but as a result of this like lower triangular behavior, it shouldn't actually affect the asymptotics. Because it doesn't affect the asymptotics p.
But it affects the ones of p tilde. Anyway, it doesn't matter, though. I don't want to.
Well, okay, maybe we can discuss later then. So this SL2 sector was like some covariant derivative, S of them, acting on some scalars. And of course, you can take this operator, for example, length 2 s equal to 2, which is this famous Parisi operator, you can solve these quantum spectral Hilbert equations either perturbatively, at weak coupling, or numerically, at finite coupling, and get some very nice results. But to do something analytically, we need to sort of move away from this single trace local operator regime. And what we want to do is look at the case of to analytically continue in spin. And in particular, consider an expansion where the spin is small. Okay, so when s goes to 0, we end up with just trace of z to the l, which is some BPS quantity, so dimension is protected. So we should have some sort of nice expansion around this point. And indeed, the expansion around this point for the dimension was worked out, I think, in full generality by Ben Basso. So for small spin, so small s, he found this expansion that delta so is L, which is the number of sites, plus this S, plus this anomalous dimension part, which depends on the spin and the coupling constant, and in particular, that this gamma S of G, a sort of nice expansion where it goes as S, and then some leading part plus higher order corrections into spin, and this leading part, which is exact to all orders in G, is known. And is given by, so to remind you that G is square root lambda over 4 pi, where lambda is Dove's coupling, that this is given by square root lambda over L, and then modified Bessel functions of the first kind. Okay, so this is exact, okay, in the coupling. So you can consider this thing a strong coupling, small, weak coupling, do expansion, whatever you want. Okay, so the question is, can we reproduce this result starting just from quantum spectral curve? And of course, the answer is yes. Otherwise, why would I be talking about it?
And you probably will be able to systematically expand and compute S square, S cube.
Yep, absolutely, yes.
Which, of course, was not known before.
Yeah. From quantum spectral curve, there is an exact analytic expression for the next leading order in the small spin expansion, so-called curvature function. So this one is called slope function, next one is called curvature function, and it's the one exactly exactly in G or lambda. Okay, so what happens to quantum spectral curve when we start looking at this small spin expansion? So if you remember these relations which we had, I'll write down one of them. So we had this A1, A4 was given by minus I over 16. Is this like readable? The chalk, is this readable? Is it okay?
It's less readable than the other one, yeah.
Yeah, okay, let's see.
Break it or take another.
Hmm?
Yeah, go on. I think it will be reasonable.
So 16 L plus 1, and then some stuff with the dimension, so minus delta plus L minus S plus 2 minus delta plus L plus S delta plus L minus S plus 2, and finally delta plus L plus S, and I'm not going to write out the other one for obvious reasons, it's big. But in any case, so when we look at this regime where delta is L plus S plus this this gamma 1 term, let's see what happens. So this A1, A4 goes So we have 2 minus gamma 1 s. Gamma 1 s. 2L plus 2. That's fine. Plus and 2L plus 2S plus S. Okay. Okay. So all in all, we see that quantity, this quantity goes like, well, something of order S plus higher order terms. Okay, so now, as a result of this symmetry, so for example, we can multiply P's P1 by A and P4 by A inverse, we can consistently, using the symmetry, set P1 to be of order like root S and P4 to be of order root S. So the combination P1 times P4, which is roughly A1 times A4, goes like S. Okay? So in this regime, these p functions are small. And that's sort of where the main simplification comes from. And in exactly the same way, if you write down the relation for A2, A3, consider the expansion in the small spin, you'll similarly find that P2 and P3 are both of like order root S, that leading order. So my point is that I'm allowed, so in general, of course, I don't know this. For example, maybe P1 goes like S, P4 goes like, say, S to the 0, or something like this. But as a result of this rescaling symmetry, I can consistently set both of them to be of order root S. So they're both small. And this leads to massive simplifications. Okay, very good. So let's look at this P mu equation. So, well, let's just look at the equation for mu. So we had mu of AB, u plus I, minus mu AB of u was PA, PB tilde, minus PA tilde PB. Okay? So knowing that these P's scale like root S, we know that the right-hand side should be of order S. Okay? So this means that at leading order, so if we write mu as, say, mu to the 0 plus mu 1 S, and what this is telling us is that this leading order, mu naught, is just a periodic function because right-hand side vanishes to leading order. So this should be periodic. And as we said, it has power-like behavior at infinity. So at most, this is constant. Okay, so then, of course, what you need to do is just solve PA tilde equals mu AB PB, where this is constant. Okay, so it seems like a noble quest. You go and do this, you find there's no solution. Okay, so there is no consistent solution for this thing which respects all of our restrictions for which this is a constant matrix. Okay?
Why is not?
Well, I mean, if you just... So you can write an ansatz for these p's, right? You can write some expansion to some basis of functions. You try to solve these relations.
But it's that side, so are you?
I'm sorry?
When you say you do something like expansion for large U?
Well, you can do expansion for large U, yeah. But so.
Well, that's, okay.
So you will write an expansion in a basis of functions which takes into account this dependence on cots. I'll show you exactly how I did it. But my point is that if you try to do this procedure with this being a periodic constant matrix, there's no solution. I mean, you can just do the computation, but. The fact that there's no solution is not the point. The point is...
You're requiring them on the board?
Yeah. Yeah. So with specified asymptotics at infinity, specified asymptotics at infinity, and these discontinuity relations. Okay, so what, is it okay?
Yeah.
All right, so the question then is, what is the catch? So the catch is that all of these restrictions that we imposed were valid for this case of single trace local operators, okay? And the point is that this thing, this d to the s, z to the l, when we expand in a small spin, is no longer a single trace local operator because s is no longer integer, okay? So we need to relax some of the requirements on these things in order to capture these type of operators, okay? So the simplest thing that we can relax looking at these is to relax the condition that this mu is a constant matrix. So we see that it has to be periodic, but the simplest change we could possibly make is to keep everything else the same, but allow this mu to start having some exponential asymptotics, okay? And there are other ways to motivate this as well, which I don't have time to do. For example, one can look at the weak coupling limit, where, as was mentioned, like discussed by Alex in the previous, at the end of the previous lecture, that these mu's become sort of Q functions of an SL2 spin chain, and it is known how to analytically continue those to the case of non-integer spin. And the way to do it is that you give these Q functions some exponential asymptotics. So when we go to finite coupling, the natural sort of guess is that this mu should now be allowed to have exponential asymptotics as well, no longer just power-like. And indeed, as we see, that will lead to the correct answer. I'm sorry?
Or L equals to 2 only.
You can also do it for higher length.
You know how to deal with the degeneracy-centric coupling?
So for this class of operators, there should be no degeneracy for this like small spin expansion. So of course you do have the
family that passes by the BPS operator. So it's the lowest family.
So of course if you just generically do a weak coupling expansion, then you of course have degeneracies. But the point is that at like higher orders in perturbation theory, these degeneracies should lift. And this was like when this big series of paper by Di Mavola and Christian Marbo, they really examined these degeneracies and they saw like lifting at higher orders in perturbation theory. Okay, so this is bad. So we allow mu to have exponential asymptotics.
P's to have those asymptotics?
No, I still require P to have power-like asymptotics. So I require
yes.
P.
So P tildes are going to have exponential.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you'll see explicitly, because we will explicitly write down like P tilde explicitly. You'll see these like singed terms and so on in these expressions. Okay.
And in the original, in one of the formulas you wrote, mu could be related to these Q's, right?
Yeah.
So this is it like saying that Q's have exponential behavior?
Nope. Let's. I was expecting no one to remember this formula, but since you do remember, yeah, I can explain this.
You can write on the sideboard if it's a side remark.
This one?
Yeah,
it's quite small. So you remember we had this formula, which was like mu AB was equal to, so Q A slash I, and then we had this matrix G IJ Q B slash J. So in the case of local operators, I told you that mu was just, mu had power-like asymptotics, and this G was a constant matrix. So now the point is that actually these Qs still have power-like asymptotics, but this G can become a periodic matrix with exponential asymptotics. So this G is like so-called gluing matrix, which is just some, well, very simple matrix, which depends on, say, like constants, some sinh, some cosh. But yeah, the modification is that this guy can have exponential asymptotics.
Do you know what these Qs on the right-hand side become at weak coupling?
Weak coupling. So I don't have an exact formula, but you can solve them because you can write.
So the G was.
I'm sorry.
I blinked. I missed what the Gij was.
So in the case of single trace local operators, G is just a constant matrix.
Okay.
Just some constant matrix. Of course, it's constrained, but for us, it's a constant matrix. And in the case of this analytic continuation in spin, it becomes a matrix with periodic entries. So for example, it has some sinh dependence, some cosh dependence, like this, which reflects the fact that our mu now also has these exponential asymptotics.
Okay.
Sorry, Alex,
by the Qs, you still want to be polynomial behavior.
Not polynomial, but power-like. In power-like, yeah, yeah. So for Alex's question, what are these Qs that are we coupling? So to my understanding, so a leading order, if I remember correctly, like P's at leading order become like some like rational function or something like this, if I remember correctly. And the point is that you solve some finite difference equation with these rational functions as like a source term, and you end up with some like eta function which has some like infinite number of poles.
Maybe let me anticipate a question that's probably for tomorrow. But we usually in SOV we write inner products in the spin chain and we couple it as integrals over Qs, right?
Yeah.
You think one can write as integrals over Qs in the SL2 spin chain?
It might be possible, yeah.
Because that would be a way to continue in spin.
Yeah.
Where did this G come from?
That's a long story. So I wrote all of these relations for analytic continuation of P functions. And my statement is that knowing how P functions are defined on all of their sheets is enough to fix the entire system. So P's were defined as being sort of the functions which carry sort of S, mostly carry S5 degrees of freedom.
So G was not there at all.
G was not there at all. G is not there at all.
When you were doing operators.
No.
It's a new thing.
It's a new thing.
For analytic continuation.
Yeah. So mu governs analytic continuation of P's. However, there's also the Q's which carry ADS5 degrees of freedom.
Yes.
And G is related to analytic continuation of these guys. But I haven't talked about that. I'm completely keeping discussion to the level of P and mu. I don't care about G.
Okay.
Is it all right? More questions?
So G controls the analytic continuation of Q's?
Yeah.
So that could have been a QQ tilde, you're saying.
So
in a sense. Okay, not exactly.
In a sense, you're correct. However, the problem is notation where Q can mean many different things. So not this Q, mm-hmm. but another guy who is also called Q, but more like blackboard Q.
Yes.
Okay. There's another guy who's like an analog of P, and then this G is related to analytic continuation of this guy. Okay, so... Yes, okay. So I was moving some board, I think, to this one. So,
I've asked this question before, but let me ask it again while you're changing the blackboard. So,
yep.
This spectral curve must have, something like this spectral curve must appear in other systems too. I mean, we really like Rigoffer's square mills because we like it.
Yep.
Like spin chains for SL2 or whatnot. How much of this beautiful structure is really special to the problem at hand? And how much is a more general feature of a class of integrable systems?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I mean, the equations themselves
seem
to be general. I mean, I have this QQ system for some algebra based on some rank. I mean, I write it down.
Mm-hmm.
What is special to n equals 4 super Young Mills is really just the analytic structure which we impose on these solutions. So I was saying, I'm not sure if you were there in the first lecture, the point is that for all integral systems based on some given algebra, in this case SL4/4, the equations that we write down, these QQ relations, are exactly the same. And what singles out a given integral model is the analytic requirement we place on these functions.
Yes.
I mean, n equals 4 super Young Mills is sort of unique in that, well, I don't want to say it's unique in that we see branch points. We see branch points in other integral models as well. For example, the one-dimensional Hubbard model has a very similar structure.
So somehow these extra sheets with a P tildes, that's already quite special.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. So from my understanding, this was like the first example of where this structure was obtained. Because even if you do like 2D integral models, like for example, like Sinch-Gordon or something like this, these Q functions are usually like some entire functions. And you don't see any of this like fancy cut structure or anything like this.
Thank you.
So it's rear, right? Okay. And of course, as I said, I can't go into all of the details about why we should give mu in the specific way that I'm going to give it, but I just ask that you trust me, and we'll see that it will lead to the correct answer. Of course, you can motivate it further based on like what I said earlier, but at the end of the day, we want to write mu in the following way. So this is mu, well, I'll just write the components, it's easier. So mu 1, 2 is 1. mu 3 4 is 1, and I want to put mu 1 3 as being sinh of 2 pi u. And then as a result of the fact that this mu is an anti-symmetric matrix, fixes some of the other components, so mu 2 1 is minus 1, for example, and after that I want to put all other elements of mu to 0. So all other zero.
So there is no S in your mu.
Correct. So you see in this formula I wrote, so mu at the leading order now does not depend on S. So you see it's mu is mu naught. This is my mu naught. Right. So yeah. In this notation, this is like this mu naught, the leading order in the spin expansion.
It's a bit confusing, right? Because then if this is supposed to match the operators at integer S somehow, right?
So this formula I'm writing is just valid at the leading order in the spin expansion. You need to then, so you can solve the system here, you can iterate to the next order in S, and in principle, you can like resum all of this thing and get back to the, in principle, to all other zero. And then of course.
Still a fair question to ask. Exactly at spin S equal to zero, the solution should be trivial, right? At S equal to zero, there should be nothing to the right.
Yeah. But I'm not at exactly S equal to zero because you see, so mu has S equal to zero. However, P, my P's, which really are the ones who carry the information, go like root S. So they're non-trivial at first order.
Exactly. At S equal to zero, I could say P's are zero.
Yeah. Because S equal to zero.
Normally, I would say mu is the mu that is the usual mu that is used.
Yeah, but
for,
if the P's are zero, then mu is
but
zero.
Mu is zero.
Yeah. Or at least constant and trivial, and indeed, yeah. Because you see, when S goes to zero, delta, this A1, A4 is exactly zero, P's are zero, but also this corresponds to the fact that we're at the BPS regime.
Yeah, okay. So my question, follow up? Yeah.
Do you have a question?
Yeah, if the spin was 2, what
yeah.
would be mu?
Some insanely complicated function.
Ah, so mu for it, okay, I see.
So my point is, I would need to compute mu, so this is mu at leading order, I need to compute it at next leading order, next to next leading order, resum up this whole thing, analytically continue, put S equal to 2. But, so this is all valid at leading order.
And maybe it should become a constant.
Mu a constant?
No, whatever you need for the operators, really.
Yeah.
Non-exponential.
Yeah, for sure, this exponential behavior should drop out. You get some like power-like behavior. Yeah, that should absolutely happen. Yeah. Yep. Okay. So,
computedly in this arbitrary, this complicated mess, can you at least compute the coefficient of exponential growth as a function of S?
Compute the coefficient of exponential growth. Compute coefficient of which?
So, suppose I only look at large u in our
case,
e to the u, perhaps.
Yeah.
E to u times a function of S. Do you think you could perhaps determine that function of S and see that it has zeros?
Maybe it's different. Maybe the next term is exponential 4 pi u.
No, so it indeed keeps going as e to the 2 pi u the whole way.
Yes, the coefficient of e to the 2 pi u might be a function of s, which has zeros on the integers.
Yeah, that's actually correct. So actually, I'm getting sidetracked, but so for example, this g, which depends, again, is some the fact that this can grow exponentially is related to the fact that this can grow exponentially. And for example, I'm pretty sure that you find like, for example, you would find something like sinh 2 pi u, and then something like 1 minus e to the I pi s. You can find stuff like this. Stuff like this, yeah. Okay, so we have written down mu's. We can finally write down these relations, p tilde equals mu p, and solve them. So it's okay over here, you can see. So P tilde A equals mu AB PB. What you end up with at the end of the day is two very simple relations, which is P4 tilde equals P2 and P1 tilde equals P3 plus sinh of 2 pi u P2. So now you see explicitly on the second sheet, this is P in the second sheet, asymptotically we'll have these exponentially growing terms as well. Yeah. And now we solve. This is rear. Okay, very good. So, at the end of the day, what we want to do is write down an explicit solution for these p's. So how do we do this? So what we can ask is, how to efficiently parameterize p's. Okay, so what we know about p's is that on the defining sheet, they have a single branch cut between minus 2g and 2g and power-like asymptotics at infinity and no other singularities. Okay, so such a function can be written very conveniently as a power series expansion in this Zhukovsky variable which we had earlier. So remember, we had this Zhukovsky variable, which was x of u is equal to u over 2g plus square root of u minus 2g. U over 2g plus 1, u over 2g minus 1. And a statement is that any function which has these properties, a single branch cut between minus 2g and 2g, and power-like growth at infinity and no other singularities, can be written as some series, say some x to some integer power, and then say something like 1 plus n equals 0, say m equal to 0, to infinity of some coefficients cn over xn. And this converges everywhere on the defining sheet. Okay, but let's be more precise. So this is rough. Let's be precise. So yeah, I need to change my thing. I ran out of paper. Yeah, okay. So this P2, let's do P4. So P4, we said that infinity went like A4U. So let's look at how this Zhukovsky variable goes, well, this thing at infinity goes like U over G. So what we want to do is take this and instead write gx, so this combination goes like u at infinity, and then some expansion in coefficients. So say n is 0 to infinity, cn4 over x to the n. Okay, so this completely characterizes p4 on the defining sheet. And similarly, this p2 will go like A2, and then 1 over gx, because we know it goes like 1 over u at infinity, and then 1 plus n is 0 to infinity, some new constants cn2.
This time you want 1, right? Not 2.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Okay. So now we need to use these equations to fix these coefficients. Okay, so it's very easy. So what this one is telling us is that if we analytically continue P4 to the second sheet, we should get P2. Okay, so how do we analytically continue this thing easily? We use the fact that this x tilde on the second sheet is 1 over x. So all we need to do is replace, to compute P2 tilde, is compute, replace x at 1 over x. So to be consistent, I'll do P4. So P4 tilde will now be, so A4.
It's linear.
So A4 G over X, and then 1 plus N equals 1 infinity C N 4 X to the N. Is it okay?
Yes.
Okay. All right, so I'm just taking this relation, replacing x to 1 over x everywhere, and my equations tell me this must be equal to p2. Okay? But now we see, how can this possibly be equal to p2? Because here we have all of these growing terms. Was this, is this your comment?
Or,
yeah. So the only way where this can possibly match this thing is if all these cn2s and these cn4s are exactly 0. Okay? Because this one is decaying, this one is growing. So we need cn2 to be cn4 to be 0. And we just get the super simple relation. So p4 is just a4 g of x, and p2 is a2 over gx, right? And of course we need to fix that these asymptotics match. So again, if we analytically continue, p4, so p4 tilde is a4 g over x, which must be equal to p2, and as a result we read off that a4 g squared should be equal to g2. Okay? And now we need to go and do the same thing with this second beast. And of course, the fact that we have sinh will complicate things, and the fact that we have sinh will actually give us something interesting for the conformal dimension. So what can die? I guess that.
But, so you're just going to Lorentz expand in x.
Yeah. I mean, in practice, it's trivial, but I mean, you get an interesting answer, so it can still be nice. But indeed, I mean, this can be expanded into positive x modes, negative x modes, and then like analyze these separately, essentially do exactly what I did here, and solve. So that's mid, is that the front? I want mid. Okay, so we want to more or less repeat the same trick where we write everybody as convergent expansions in x, but we have this sinh of 2 pi u, which we want to write in terms of x. So I want to make sure I don't get a factor wrong. Yes. So this Zhukovsky variable satisfies the following relation, which is u equals g x plus 1 over x, which you can check from like this specific relation. Okay, so now let's look at sinh 2 pi u. Which is, well, first of all, let's analyze exponential of 2 pi u. Okay? Which is now exponential of 2 pi g x plus 1 over x. And those of you who are familiar with modified Bessel functions of the first kind will immediately recognize this as the generating series for those functions. So n is minus infinity to infinity. In of 4 pi g, so this is a modified Bessel function of the first kind with index n, and then x to the n. And then when we use the relation for sinh in terms of exponentials, this Sinh will amount to being the generating function of the odd Bessel functions. So Sinh 2 pi u is sum from n equals minus infinity to infinity I 2n plus 1 x to the 2n plus 1. And now I want to do exactly what Davide suggested and split into positive modes and negative modes. So I want to write this using this notation, which I'll call s minus of x plus s plus of x, where s minus of x is just n equals so 0 to infinity. S plus of x is x to the 2n plus 1. I 2n plus 1 and s minus x is the same with x goes to 1 over x. 1 over x to the 2n plus 1 I 2n plus 1. Okay? And as you can probably expect, these functions s plus and s minus will be sort of building blocks for my p's, my p2 and p3, whose analytic continuation contained Sinh. Okay, so I could do exactly as I said before, just write all of these guys as a series expansion in 1 over x, do the same thing with Sinh, just match powers on both sides and then get the solution. For this, that would take too long, so I'm going to make a slightly more clever and that's for the solution, which is of course equivalent to this, but will speed up the writing process.
Why is it long? Sorry.
I'm sorry?
Why is it long? I mean, you're just taking p2, dividing by x, and splitting, right? And you've already got p.
Yeah, but then I have to match power by power in x. I mean,
it's already s plus and s minus.
Yeah.
What matching is there to do?
Yeah, okay. I mean, I'm going to do that, but just in a more like, in a faster way, a streamlined way. But what I'm doing is exactly equivalent to this. It's...
You already did it.
Well, okay, I mean, if you're happy at this level, I can just write down the answer. It's up to you. Or should I, like, do the computation?
No, write the answer.
Write the answer? No computation?
It's already done. I think we can do by hand, yeah.
Yeah, of course you can do by hand. Yeah, that's the whole point.
By hand.
Okay. Okay, fine, we do that. Suddenly, like, 20 minutes have been cut off this lecture.
As today, we can ask questions for 20 minutes.
Yeah, sure, perfect.
Recoupling questions.
Okay, so all in all, this is me scrolling through my notes to actually get to the answer. All in all, we find P1 equals, so I need to be certain I did not screw this up. I think I did not. Well, we'll see if I get the wrong answer at the end. So P1 should be minus A4. G Bessel I1 plus this S minus of X over X. Okay? And P3 minus sign. P3 is equal to minus A4 G I1 plus s minus over x. This should hopefully be correct. Yeah, that seems okay. And then, of course, so we have solutions for all these functions. Now we want to read off the conformal dimension of this representation. So how do we do this? We had this formula, which I guess is erased, which said like a1, a4 equals function of delta. So we want to compute this a1, a4. So doing this, just expanding at large x, using the fact that x is equal to u over g, at large u, we read off the component of u. And what we end up getting is a1 is a4 g cubed. a2 is a4 g squared. And A3, a bit more interesting, is minus a4 g Bessel i1. I forgot a Bessel. i3. Much better. Is this signs correct? Yeah, seems okay. Okay, we can kill this.
You can also just raise the board and use a fork.
I'm sorry?
You can just raise and use the one that is empty behind both of those. Just raise the mid, the front, and the medium.
Oh.
And the back.
Oh, there's a fourth board?
Yes.
Ah, okay.
So he's the one.
Which doesn't move.
Okay.
And it's a board, right? We're not...
Yeah, it's a board. It's a board.
So you say move...
Move the back one.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So... Earlier I wrote down the expansion of A1, A4, but to give you the explicit answer which you get at the leading order in the spin, what you'll find is, so this A1, A4 is equal to I over 2, and then this first correction to the dimension in the spin, A2 and A3 is minus I over 2, 2, plus gamma 1 s. Okay? And because these A1, I mean, there's no mention of s anywhere in these, but we know that these a's are the asymptotics of p's, which were assumed to go like root s. So we should, in fact, write, for example, a4 as being root s, a4 0, for example, okay? And then from that, consider this. Because A4 is present in all of these things, so it essentially just drops out to an overall factor, and then we can just read off this. So finally, plugging in all of these A's, we find... So first of all, so there's two unknowns at the moment, right? So we have two equations, two unknowns. Two equations are gamma 1 and also A4. So we'll just write down the answer for gamma 1 since it's the physically important thing. So this gamma 1 was 2 Bessel I3 over I1 minus I3. And you say, okay, you look at this, but okay, Paul, this is not the formula you wrote down on the very first slide. So what's the deal? So you need to use relations between Bessel functions, which in particular says... Well, one relation which says that, for example, z, I1, z, minus I3 of z is equal to 4 I2 of z. Use this relation, and finally, you end up with gamma 1 as being the thing I wrote down at the very beginning. So... 2g pi I3 4g pi I1 over 4g pi, which is exactly the slope function of Benbasso once I use the fact that square root of lambda is equal to 4 pi g. And this is the result, right? This is exact to all orders in g. And then, of course, I'm not going to do it because leading order took a while already, but the whole point is now you have a leading order solution. You have p's at leading order, right? So you can take this relation wherever I wrote it before. So mu u plus I minus mu equals combination of p's. You know p's explicitly at leading order. You can write some integral kernel which solves this relation like explicitly. You compute mu at leading order. From there, you can compute p at next to leading order. And then you're done. From there, you go through some long chain of arguments, but you, again, can read off exactly the contribution to the dimension at the next leading order in the spin. All right, so that's sort of the explicit example worked out.
And use the power series in S.
Power series in S, yeah.
I have a question about weak coupling.
Yeah.
So at weak coupling, you said that this mu could be related to the standard Baxter, a solution to the more standard Baxter equation.
Yes.
I'm more used to.
Yeah.
Okay, question number one is, if you don't mind showing it, I would like to see how it works. But the second question will be, I remember that when I tried solving this equation around s equals 0 for the usual Baxter equation, I was getting that the usual Baxter function was constant plus some harmonic functions. It was not plus periodic. So I'm a bit confused by this mu being exactly the Baxter function. It's probably not. It's probably only the Baxter function when the spin is integer, or... Mm-hmm. But okay, of course, it's better if you first answer the first question. How do I see that at weak coupling, this mu becomes the usual Baxter polynomial?
Yeah, so I can't give you an explicit derivation. It's been some time since I worked through the argument, but essentially the point is, so starting, how should we, let me see, where do I want to start from? So I'll tell you schematically. So as I said, I didn't prepare this, so it'll be a bit rough and perhaps not very enlightening, but the whole point is this equation mu ab of u plus I minus mu ab of u is pa pb tilde minus pb pa tilde. So at weak coupling, first of all, some components of mu and some components of p should essentially become very small, smaller than the rest, and should somehow decouple. Okay? So well, I don't remember the argument well enough, but essentially that this equation would become the Baxter equation. So the problem, obviously, you see immediately is that this is a first-order difference equation, not a second-order difference equation that you're familiar with. I'm trying to remember where the second order, the second term, comes from. If you give me like 2 seconds, I can check and then remember like the argument.
Let me maybe ask another question, because then we can go to a more informal discussion that people can live. At weak coupling, we can often define things more operatorially, right? Like we were discussing before, that we can sometimes really define Q operators,
yep.
Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. on. And now we have many, many Q functions and mu's and g's and so on.
Yep.
Do all of these objects have nice operatorial definitions, or only some of them?
When you say operatorial definition, you mean at finite coupling or weak coupling?
Just at weak coupling. Okay. Is there an operator that gives me g, for example, or gives me Q a slash I? And one that gives me mu.
Yeah, so at weak coupling, you can construct all of these Q functions explicitly. And this was done in a paper of...
Operators, not...
Operators. Yeah, yeah. This full tower of Q operators satisfying all of these relations and so on was done in a paper of Reuven Frasek, I think Christian Marbo as well, and someone else, David Meininger, I think, where they considered PSU 2,2/4 spin chain, explicitly constructed all Q operators. But it's one loop. I mean, the fact that you have, I mean, all of this cut structure is completely hidden. Everybody
see the P set one loop.
Hmm?
You're not going to be able to see the P set one loop.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to see this nice cut structure or anything like this.
You don't see the cuts, but you will see that some quantities will be polynomials and others will have infinitely many poles. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely.
You already see a bit of sign of the cuts. You will see an infinite set.
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
I see. So some functions... very far from polynomial already at weak coupling.
Yeah.
Eta functions or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But do you think the P sets that exist as operators at weak coupling?
I mean, with cut structure, no. But I mean, you can construct P's at weak coupling as operators, yes. But they will be some rational function at leading order.
Right.
Or maybe not irrational, but well, it. Leading order, there should be something like this, and then you start seeing this infinite tower of poles starting to appear. you can do this. You can do this like very explicitly, like CP explicitly a leading order, then build some operator which corresponds to this.
Can you see the needle of this G?
I'm sorry?
Can you see the needle of this G?
At leading order and weak coupling. Well, that's a bit ambiguous. I mean, so if you start from a weak coupling expansion, then you do need to construct all of these operators as if they had cuts, and then send G to zero. So you write some ansatz which reflects this. For example, even at weak coupling, you would still write an ansatz in terms of this x. But the point is that it would terminate at some given order related to G. And then similarly, you could construct all of these mu's and so on. You could construct this QAI, and then at leading order, at least as functions, you should see this G. Yeah.
I mean, is it fair to say that you are breaking up Baxter, which Baxter was like mu12, right? Mu12 was the usual Baxter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It looks like you're breaking it into smaller blocks, right? You're writing mu12 equal to a product of three operators.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So is this a true statement that indeed you have a Baxter operator, which is already a simple operator?
Yeah.
But it can be even simplified or maybe not simplified.
Do you think it's simple?
In SL2, it's like an integral transform.
Okay, that's simple.
It's just a single integral, right? Mm-hmm. Now you want to break it into three operations.
It's not a single integral. It's triple. It's L integrals.
Acting on two sides. You say even acting on two sides is double integral?
The Hamiltonian is a single integral.
Uh-huh.
It comes from localizing this Q integral expansion. In other words, the Hamiltonian moves the one particle towards each other, the Q operator moves all particles simultaneously.
Okay. So can we see some sign that each Q moves one? No, it's not, of course, not like that. But it's very interesting that you are saying that this exponential that we are fighting with come from one block inside Q. It would be nice to understand what is this block, because it's clearly this block is the source of all the differences between spin integer and spin continuous.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it would be nice to have a definition of what exactly is G at weak coupling. What is it as an operator?
I mean, I can give you a finite coupling definition of this G.
But these operatorial definitions are all at integer spin, right? It's when acting on spin chains and so on.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm.
So I don't think you can ask this question at compact spin.
Well, unless there is a spin chain interpretation for
compact spin, yeah, sure.
Which I think is very likely
for
the residual principal series representations or something like that.
Yeah, okay. It would be wonderful to clarify that. Yes.
At least you would know how to act on insertions on Wilson lines, right? Because
mm-hmm.
those can be expanded out in local operators. And you could translate action.
Yeah, but my question is whether
on insertions on Wilson lines.
There was a claim that these operators were constructed, but I don't think they were constructed in the language of Wilson lines.
No,
if
really.
If they are constructed with derivatives, the conversion to Wilson lines, you don't lose any information, right? Mm-hmm. The Wilson line with two insertions expands in integer space. Right? You just put an operator at zero, one at one, you just do Taylor expansion, right? So there you can go from one to the other. So if you knew how they act on derivatives, you know how it acts on insertions on the Wilson line?
Yes.
Yeah, that should be possible. I mean, this construction,
you should be
yeah.
able to understand these various building blocks, and it seems like the exponential comes from one particular one. It could be, I think, very instructive to identify what this is.
Mm-hmm. So if you want me to tell you exactly, like, G is, I can very schematically tell you. So I did everything at the level of P, which was like S5, but I could also do everything at the level of ADS5, which was this boldface Q, okay? However, if I go and explicitly construct this boldface Q by starting from P, I need to solve some finite difference equation, and as a result, this Q is going to have an infinite tower of cuts, okay? But there's not a unique choice on how I build this Q. I can choose it to be either analytic in the upper half plane, for example, by starting at infinity, shifting down, and then I'll see the cuts starting to appear in the lower half plane. This is one choice. This function we call QI down, which means it's analytic starting from the upper half plane and shifting down. However, nobody forbids me from starting at, say, minus infinity, shifting up, and then I start to see cuts appearing in the upper half plane. This is called qi up. And what this g does is relate the analytic continuation of these two functions to each other, namely, I'm sorry, qi down analytic continuation around the branch point at 2g is exactly gij qj up. Mm-hmm. And in fact, this relation, if you want to solve the whole system numerically, this is an extremely efficient way to go about it, using this relation instead of p. P is useful for this analytic result and also for weak coupling expansion, but numerically, this is kind of the thing you want to use. For reason, I mean, the point is mu had this infinite tower of cuts, but now the infinite tower of cuts are encoded in these q's, whereas this g is just either a constant matrix or some exponential function.
Oh, I see. So g is analytic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I see. That doesn't work.
But so I have like 7 minutes remaining. Maybe I can just mention like some quick comments on like what the current status of like all this is and like future directions and programs and so on. So I was actually going to prepare how to obtain like the weak coupling SL2 Baxter starting from P and mu, but I decided it'd be a better use to show the computation in explicit detail, but then you decided you didn't want that. So here we are. Well, I can look at the argument again and I can explain it later. It's
I would like to see very much, yeah.
So we have quantum spectral curve for n equals 4 super Young Mills, ABJM. And both of these quantum spectral curves are obtained more or less rigorously starting from thermodynamic beta ansatz construction. So recently, a set of quantum spectral curve equations were written down for string theory on ADS3 times S3 times T4 with pure Ramon-Ramon flux. And this is sort of an area of super active research because it was just postulated based on similarities with what we have in N equals 4 and ABGM, the symmetries and so on, knowing what the Q system should look like, and basically just guessing the answer and then checking that classically it seems valid, that you reproduce what sort of what is known from the classical spectral curve and so on. So we had a paper almost a year ago now where we like took this ADS3 quantum spectral curve, tried to do weak coupling perturbative expansion, numerical expansion, and also try to do an analog of this small spin expansion. And at leading order in small spin, it seems to give almost exactly the same thing as in n equals 4. And then suddenly at the next leading order in S, it just stopped working. So we don't really understand that. But nevertheless, so all of these things, also Wilson loops, so cost Wilson loop, but also, for example, the straight line Wilson loop corresponding to some defect, one-dimensional defect CFT. We also have quantum spectral curve for this. Lots of nice analytic, perturbatively analytic, numerical results. A big thing kind of ongoing right now is how could one write down, forget about weak coupling, but try to do a strong coupling expansion. But probably the big thing, which is ongoing right now, which is the whole point of this mini course, is, okay, quantum spectral curve is great. You solve it, you read off the conformal dimension that you're interested in, but also can we extend quantum spectral curve to other observables, in particular, three-point functions? And this story of three-point functions is very closely related to this problem of separation of variables, Alice Gleinen, in integral spin chains, which is a super cool story, which we need another lecture series to talk about. So the idea now is to somehow combine these three objects of SOV plus QSC equals exact solution. Okay, so yeah, thanks for the attention, and we can discuss afterwards. Yeah.